I'm Joe Burke from PopX Cast, a proud member of the Gonna Geek Network, just like the show you're listening to now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual host. Check out all of our podcasts at GonnaGeekNetwork.com and get ready because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
This is John Leeson. You would not believe it. It is the voice of K9 welcoming you to Gallifrey Public Radio. Please listen.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to positive enjoyment of everything in the Doctor Who spectrum. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Whitaker and beyond. Your GPR hosts are Jay Witten.
Safety measures are for chumps who don't know what they're doing.
Kier Hansen.
Oh, hold on. I saw it on my mixer. I turned up the suck. Hold on.
And Haley Malley.
I feel like I might need to carb up for next week's episode.
Oh, and
spoilers.
We do discuss recent news, episodes that have already aired in their home territories, and the occasional interesting rumor. But don't worry, if we look too far into the future, we'll give you a fair warning.
Welcome to episode 280 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where all the hoarding and late night scouring of eBay and Craigslist are finally going to pay off. Huge profits! Now, if I can just find a good magic marker to scribble prices on all these things. I'm Haley.
I'm Kier.
And I'm Jane. This week, we're fortunate enough to sit down with David J. Howe, a Whovian historian and founder of the Doctor Who Merchandise Museum, currently preparing for its grand opening in the UK.
Yeah, it's a labor of love, as the interview will attest, but something that we've been following pretty closely, as both David and Sam Stone are friends of ours, who we've been able to enjoy a lot of time and conversation with at conventions here in the States and elsewhere. And it's something that we'd like to see how well it's executed, because it's something that we would do if we had all of the... all the paraphernalia and ephemera that he's got gathered as well. So it's a lot of boxes to unpack, but we will we'll let him tell the story. So here's our interview with David, and we'll be back in just a couple minutes. David J. Howe is an author, publisher, and a devout collector of props, costumes, publications, retail, and collector's merchandise from the Doctor Who program, going back to the 70s, I believe. So to that end, he is working to convert his vast collection, along with possibly some installations by other collectors, into a dedicated museum of Doctor Who merchandise, aptly named the Doctor Who Merchandise Museum. So David, welcome at long last to Gallifrey Public Radio.
Hello, it's an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on. Now, if you wouldn't mind, I know it's a bit of a broad setup here, but would you take us a bit through your journey with the program as a viewer and a collector and then eventually a writer?
Yeah, sure, no problem at all. So, I mean, I'm very old, positively ancient now, and I started watching Doctor Who back in the 60s. So. My earliest memories are also my earliest memories of the program, which is always been a bit peculiar. I just mark the beats of my life through Doctor Who. It's very strange. But I remember watching The Tomb of the Cybermen and Evil of the Daleks and The Invasion and the Crotons and the Dominators and all sorts of good stuff like that way back in the 60s. I remember not watching the Seeds of Death. It was the Ice Warriors. I remember not watching the Ice Warriors because I was having nightmares, and my parents decided that it was the show causing the nightmares, so I wasn't allowed to watch the Ice Warriors. But my brother did, and I have a memory of me being outside the living room door as my brother's taunting me from inside the living room door, pretending to be an Ice Warrior because I couldn't see it on the television. That was all very funny. So I started watching it very early, and I started collecting things probably mid-70s, by dint of not throwing things away. I know that sounds a bit weird, but in my collection, I've got my original Radio Times cuttings from like Monster of Peladon and Planet of the Spiders, which I obviously collected from the Radio Times back at that time. I also got my first Target book in 1974, which was the Curse of Peladon book. And I got the Making of Doctor Who, the old Piccolo paperback, in which came out in 72. So I kind of started to just keep things, really.
Okay.
And then it just sort of continued from there. So, I mean, it sort of went on. So, you know, flash forward to 1976, when I joined the Doctor Who Appreciation Society. Decided to do a fanzine for the first ever convention in 1977. So I did that, and then that developed into Oracle, my fanzine, which ran sort of through the rest of the 70s and into the 80s. End of the 80s or mid-80s, we started to do another fanzine called The Frame, which we ran through into the early 90s. And then in the early 90s, I was lucky enough to get to do some books with Virgin, and 60s, 70s, 80s, and the handbooks and stuff, which was great. So, you know, finally all this gathered knowledge about Doctor Who that I'd been collecting, you know, we could put it to good use. Plus, of course, I was kind of collecting all the books and the magazines. Doctor Who magazine, of course, started in 1979. And all of the Palatoid, Cyberman and Dalek and stuff came out about 76, 77, and I got all those. So I was kind of just like collecting stuff, really. And it's just gone on from there. So I've got this vast collection of stuff now. And it was really a question of, well, what do we do with all of this stuff? We were living in North Wales in the UK, and we had a lovely eight-bedroom house there. And one of the bedrooms was given over to all my Doctor Who collection. But it was absolutely, you know, groaning at the seams. It was completely full. So we kind of decided that we needed to find somewhere else to live, where I could perhaps better house the collection rather than having it all stuffed into a bedroom. So we started to look around for somewhere with a bit of land that I might be able to build something on, or something with a big outhouse, or, you know, something that we could use to sort of keep all this stuff in. And eventually we ended up with this place in Lincolnshire, that's the other side of the country, really, in England, where we've got a lovely house, but we've also got a very large business unit, which we immediately decided we could use that as a house for the collection and for Telos Publishing and the books and stuff, and it could all be there, and and we could look after it properly. And so that's what we did. So we moved over here 4 years ago, 5 years ago, whatever it was, and really it's been like an ongoing project ever since, is okay. To work out what the devil to do, how to do it, and then to sort of convert this outbuilding into something that could be used for a private museum.
Okay, so
which is what we've really managed to achieve.
Right. So where would you say the preparations are at present? I know a lot of this has been actual your own sweat equity in putting into this. So where?
Absolutely,
are we?
Yeah. I mean, we did do a kind of like a Kickstarter type fundraiser, because we realised that the money that we needed it wasn't going to happen. It's a long and complicated story. But I had a massive heart attack about 3 years ago now, which obviously meant I couldn't work. So obviously there was no money coming in. And therefore, you know, we needed the money to be able to do the museum. It was a pain in the bottom, really. But we managed to sort of get there, partly through the fundraiser, partly through, you know, my own money and stuff that I had. And so where we are now is we've managed to convert about half the space I've got into this place that we can put the museum. I'm very pleased with it. It's all kitted out now. We've put all the shelves up. We've got all the cabinets in. Lighting's all done. It's basically finished. It's all done. And it's really just waiting for me to be able to have time to unpack all my thousands of boxes of Doctor Who stuff and reacquaint myself.
Sure.
With everything that I've got, and get it all kind of placed in the museum, so it's all, you know, be nicely displayed and accessible again, okay. Which will be lovely.
Right, along with the necessary cataloging process and so forth that goes with.
Yeah, that's one of the things that kind of it's yeah, we kind of decided we needed to do a catalog, and of course, sort of realizing and not realizing simultaneously that that means that I can't just, you know, literally tear open boxes and throw stuff onto shelves. Mm-hmm. It has to go through a process of being photographed and cataloged and done properly. And that's kind of what's slowing it down a little bit at the moment, because that's quite a big ask. You know, plus we're very busy. We're both working and we've got stuff going on and all sorts of other stuff that's intruding on the available time that we have.
Sure.
And of course, you know, the museum is sort of having to take a little bit of a backseat at the moment while we, you know, get ourselves to a position where we can actually spend some time every day going down there and doing stuff. So. Yeah, it's very exciting though because it looks great. I'm very pleased with it.
Oh, great!
It's pretty good.
What sort of variety of the various merchandise and materials are in the museum from the great to the small? I mean, how large of pieces versus something as small as a lapel pin or something of that sort?
Well, to be honest, it's everything. I mean, I've had friends who kind of specialised in their collecting, in that they would only collect the books, for example. Or people only collect the little figures, you know, the plastic character options figures and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I've always collected everything. So it's like if it had the Doctor Who logo on it, if it had the name Doctor Who on it, I wanted it, I would collect it. So, I mean, my collection spans, you know, just about everything. It goes right back to the 60s, because obviously I backfilled on some of the stuff that came out before I started to actually keep it. I haven't got an awful lot of 60s stuff, but I've got a fair number of toys and games and puzzles and models and things from the 60s.
Hmm.
It covers everything, as I said there, from your toys and games, puzzles, all the books, CDs, of course, videos, DVDs, right the way down to the little metal figures, the gaming figures that they do, and also, you know, lapel pins, as you said, and beer mats and... As I say, if it had Doctor Who on it, then I collected it. So I've got boxes and boxes and boxes just full of the most incredible array of stuff that's all related to Doctor Who. You know, going back, you know, 7 years?
54 and change.
55 years, something like that.
As specifically with the emphasis on the retailed or distributed merchandise that had to do with the program,
yeah.
Does that mean that you're going to be omitting things that were actual props, costumes, set pieces, and things like that from the program proper?
I've never kind of got a great bundle on the actual props and costumes and stuff.
Okay.
I do have some, and I'm very happy with the ones I've got. And what we've decided to do is we're kind of giving over a large corner of the museum to a little display of original props and costumes and bits and bobs that I've picked up over the years that is to do with the program. But it's by no means a lot, you know. I mean, if we're talking 30 items, I'd be surprised. I probably haven't got that many, but...
Okay.
The problem is that these things creep up on you and hit you over the head unawares, you know, and I say that and then I'll probably discover I've got 50 or something, you know, but it's not an awful lot of props and costumes that I think I've got, but we will be trying to display them and put them in the museum as well, because you've got to put them somewhere,
sure.
You know, and I might as well put them on display so people can enjoy them and see them and they look nice, and that's the thing, with it all to sort of get all that stuff together. I mean, the other thing that's fascinating about the merchandise is that it's kind of, in some respects, you get a history of technology as well. In the, I did a talk a couple of years ago, which sort of took as an example one of the Doctor Who's that was, sort of released on various media. And, of course, Doctor Who first released on... 78 RPM records with the Chase CD soundtrack, not CD, record back in the 60s. So you kind of go from records and then you sort of go into tapes and you've got Doctor Who tapes and then you've got like, then you can move into, you know, video and then you've got laser discs and you've got UMD video and then you've got DVDs and now you've got Blu-rays. And of course, you've also got streaming.
Mm-hmm.
So Doctor Who has been released in just about every single format that's ever been invented. And you can trace the history of that through Doctor Who. It's quite fascinating. And I've got a theory that the only format that Doctor Who never, ever appeared in was 8-track cartridge. I've yet to find an 8-track cartridge of Doctor Who.
It's very true. I hadn't really thought about the 8-track
tapes. But just about every other format that's ever been invented, Doctor Who has been released on it. It's quite extraordinary. Wax Cylinders perhaps isn't, but then that kind of predated it. So
it's a cuneiform, yeah.
That was gone by the time Doctor Who started.
What would you consider to be the sort of the crown jewels of the collection, in your opinion?
People ask me that. I like all the stuff pretty much equally. And part of the problem I've got at the moment is because it's all been packed in boxes for kind of 5 or 10 years, I've sort of forgotten what I've got in some respects. So I'm very much looking forward to be able to go through my boxes and going, oh, yes, I remember. Oh, yes, I had one of those. I mean, I've got some lovely stuff from the 60s. I've got like the original 60s Mark's Dalek in a box, which I'm very fond of. Like War of the Daleks game I like. There's an awful lot of magazines. I kind of quite like poster magazines and stuff like that through the years. Now, there's lots and lots of stuff. But as I say, it's very hard to pick out. It's like asking you which is your favourite child, you know. not a question you can really answer. They're all my favourites.
It's very true.
Smashing fellows, all of them.
I imagine that unpacking process is going to cause a little additional loss of time as you just revel in what you rediscover. Yes. Yeah. Well, can
Absolutely.
Others... Yeah. Can others who are interested in personal collections of Who merchandise be of any help in this, or is this something that's your own personal labor of love?
Well, I think at the moment it's absolutely my own personal labor of love. I mean, I've had a few notes from people saying, "Oh, am I interested? Do I want?" And as I said, the problem is at the moment is that I've got a pretty good idea what I've got, but I don't know absolutely what I've got. Mm. So it's not until I actually get this all set up and running that I will then know, well, even whether we've got space to have, you know, other people's bits and bobs and stuff coming in. I'm certainly not adverse to it, but it's not something that I'm necessarily looking for at this point, yeah? Mm. It's kind of, let's get this going. Let's set it up with my stuff. Let's get this private museum sorted, and then we can see if there's any scope for, you know, further expansion or anything else that we might need, and what haven't I got, kind of thing.
Sure.
And I'm kind of in a way, I'm kind of looking forward to getting the catalogue so I can go, oh, I haven't got that. Can I find it on eBay? You know, and trying to sort of, you know, plug some gaps and holes and things, and just see how that goes. But yeah, no, at the moment, yeah, not really looking for donations or offers of stuff per se, because as I say, I don't know what I've got to display in the first place, or even if even with all this space I've got, whether or not it's enough to take everything that I have got. So we just have to see.
Okay. Well, now, as we've mentioned here, you've published a wide number of Doctor Who reference and companion books.
Yeah.
Some that focus on particular eras in the program, some about the target novelization range. There's even Howe's Transcendental Toy Box, which actually helps others with the identification and cataloging of merchandise. So, and it even spans into things like screenplays for spin-off concepts, and these were all with Telus Publishing. So, between your writing efforts and the preparations for the museum, and how your energy toggles back and forth between them, which is more near and dear to you?
That's a good question. No one's ever asked me that before. I think I don't think anyone is. I think it's all important. I mean, there's an old adage, isn't there, is if you want something done, ask a busy person. And I seem to have so much stuff going on all the time that I don't have much of a chance to sit back and, you know, smell the daisies, as it were. And we're always very, very busy, always doing lots and lots of things. And Telos is obviously publishing lots of books that aren't by me. We've got lots of great novels and short story collections and crime books and factual guides and all sorts of stuff coming out that I'm not writing, but obviously I'm involved in publishing and doing cover design for, and, you know, steering to publication and all this kind of thing. that, you know, as I said, we're just always busy. And, you know, sometimes it does get a little bit kind of, oh, I'd just like to be able to have a weekend off kind of thing, but that never happens. So, you know, I couldn't choose one over the other at this point, I'm afraid. Yeah.
Well, it does end up putting quite a few lines in the CV and a lot of things to add to the list of accomplishments there. But all right, I guess we can kind of, you know, close the conversation here by asking what is your proudest accomplishment to date?
Oh, God.
the laurel with which you can rest upon.
Oh, I have no idea, Kia. It's like, it's a classic dichotomy that, you know, whatever it is you're doing, you always want to be doing the thing that you're not doing.
Okay.
You know, I'm sure there's something that Stephen King would love to be doing, and he's killing himself and beating himself up about because he's not doing it, you know. Mm. Maybe he'd like his own radio show or something. I have no idea. But there will be something that Stephen King feels that his life is incomplete because he hasn't done it, you know?
Right.
And it's the same with everybody, actors, creative people the world over, you know, that it's always, you know, the thing that you haven't done is the thing that you obsess about. And you tend to forget all the things that you have done. I mean, I've been very, very lucky over the years, in the sense that, you know, I've been a massive fan of Doctor Who. I love the show. I love the behind-the-scenes element of the show. That led me to actually, you know, go and try and interview people, talk to people about it, which was one of the reasons for doing the fanzine. So, you know, I could go and talk to people and then write up the interview or whatever in my magazine, which is fantastic. Gives you an excuse to go and find all this stuff out. But in finding all this stuff out, you then find that you've got a lot of information and a lot of things that are useful that enables you then to be able to write books, and you know there's a publisher there that's kind of sympathetic to talking to you about that, so you get to do a whole load of books, which is obviously absolutely fantastic, and I'm very proud of all the books that we did. I still think they stand up today, as you know, in terms of what we wanted them to be. I don't think they've been surpassed. Yeah, we found out more stuff about the show. You know, there's more detail about certain elements and stuff, but that wasn't the point of the books. The point of the books was to document what we documented, and we did it in the best way that we could. So that was smashing. You know, publishing is great. You get to break new names. Some great fiction comes out that, you know, you really want to see published, and you can get it out there. Sales may or may not come. You just have to try your best. That's the way it is with everything, isn't it? You know, my wife's got a radio show, which we really enjoy doing every month. So that's good fun. We're doing the Merchandise Museum. That's great. We're involved in organizing conventions. And in fact, you know, the next big one is weekend after next, the big sci-fi weekender in the UK. 7,000 odd people rocking up and partying all weekend. So we're very heavily involved in organizing and helping with that. Like I say, it's like, you know, sometimes we don't have time to turn around and breathe. But... yeah, I'm very proud of everything that I've done. I mean, if I wasn't proud of it, I wouldn't do it, you know.
Precisely, yeah.
You know, you kind of, that's the way you roll. So, yeah.
Excellent.
Good stuff.
Well, before we allow you to continue about your evening and sort of digest all the information about the museum and everything else you've shared with us, we want to play a quick little game with you, if you'd oblige us.
Okay.
Anytime we have a new guest on, we play a quick game that we refer to as Five Rounds Rapid. So it's a couple of.
My name's not Jenkins, but I'll do my best.
We'll see how you can do with a fully automatic line of questions here. So, question the first: what was your absolute, as far as you can recall, your first Who story?
What I saw on television.
Mm-hmm.
That I saw on television.
Yes, sir.
That would have been Evil of the Daleks.
Okay. All right. That tracks with your collection as well, as far as when you immediately started picking up on the materials from that era. Okay, question the second. A lot of people will always ask, who's your doctor and so forth. We don't really care about those things. We want to know, who's your companion?
Okay. Who's my companion?
Mm-hmm.
Whew. I don't really have a companion. My doctor would be Patrick Troughton.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the one that I grew up with and I fell in love with way back in the 60s. And watching those stories again today still fills me with thrill because I still think they're brilliant. Companion is a very difficult. I never really had an affinity with a companion.
Okay.
It's a difficult one. I mean, you know, I could say Jamie because, of course, he was with Troughton for the whole time. Sarah Jane, I quite liked. I thought Leela, I thought was good. Joe didn't kind of gel with me quite so much, nor did Zoe or Victoria. So possibly those three-ish.
Okay. All right. There's a pattern to them. There's a pattern to them, I think, in terms of their determination. Yeah. What are you most hoping for from the new series coming this autumn?
Good stories.
Okay. It all comes down to the story.
It all comes down to the story. All yeah. Right. Good plots, good stories, good adventures.
Excellent. On that note, then, the fourth question here for you is your preference the sort of the bottle episode one and done stories versus a multi-story arc or a long game series arc?
Individual stories.
Okay. Why would that be?
Absolutely individual stories. I have no problem with series arcs, and I have no problem with, you know, stories that have elements that feed into something that's resolved at the end. Doesn't bother me. I would be very disappointed if each individual episode actually had no plot and ended up all being one great big long kind of nothing story that maybe or didn't come to a satisfactory end at the end. I would much rather have individual episodes which are individual stories, which are adventures. And I have to say as well, I vastly prefer the classic series format of, you know, four or six or three or two or whatever episodes per story, rather than, you know, a 45-minute episode being the whole story. I just don't think that's long enough to be able to develop what you need to develop to tell a good story. So,
okay,
just my view.
That's absolutely valid. The last question for you then. The doctor opens the TARDIS door, extends their hand, and asks you, anywhere in time and space, where do you want to go?
I have no idea off the top of my head, I'm afraid. No clue. No clue at all. It would be tempting to go... I don't know, 5,000 years in the future and see if humanity even manages to survive.
5,000. Let's just see if we can make it 500. Or...
Let's see if we can just make it 5. it would be interesting to go back 2,000 years to, you know, Palestine and Jerusalem and just see what that dude Jesus is getting up to. That might be quite interesting. Don't know. Yeah. Something like that, perhaps.
Something to ponder then. Well, as we've been delighted to have this opportunity, we've been speaking with David J. Howe, as a Whovian historian of note and the founder of the Doctor Who Merchandise Museum, currently in preparations for a future grand opening in the UK. David, thank you for spending time with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Cheers.
All right, so I have to say that I am thoroughly impressed with his dedication because the closest I've ever come to a collection like that is I think I had 6 or 7 Star Wars Pez back in like the late 90s.
Did you
I
take them out?
I have a lot of Marvel Funkos now.
Okay. New in box?
I take them out of the box.
Of course. They're no fun to play with still in the box. All right.
Yeah. How's the cat going to chew off the doctor's foot if it's still in the box?
The True. Worst one is there's a tiny little Ant-Man that came with the Ant-Man one, like an inch tall. And the cats constantly knock that one off the shelf and play with it.
You're going to have to glue it to the shelf now. It's the only solution.
So, I mean, I unfortunately, now that the Doctor Who experience is gone, I mean, this has just moved up to the top of my must-see list when I get to the UK.
Yeah, that's true. Hopefully completion will come about, well, weather permitting, ever since the conversations we've been having with it. He's been reminding me about how heavily it's been raining up to the point where they're concerned with flooding in for the all the flooring that was poured for everything. So fingers crossed that continues and that he can get to the cataloging of everything as he'd planned to. But we will keep watch, and we'll make sure that we share all of the ways that you can keep track of his exploits on Twitter, the museum's progress on Facebook, and everything in between.
Well, along with those updates, we have some other news as well.
We do have some news. It's funny because this news all seems to, well, I should say, in large part, revolves around things in collectible format, that being novelizations, but not your usual, you know, pulp used paper stand novelization. These are the new novelizations. So let's get to those first. A lot of conversation about the updated Target novelizations that have been coming about. Namely, the two that were penned by our previous showrunners, Russell T. Davies and Stephen Moffat. Who do you want to delve into first?
Oh, geez.
Davies came first, so let's talk about him first.
Okay. Apparently, as he was writing his Rose novelization, as you are wont to do, you have absolutely all creative license to be able to embellish upon the story as you see fit. He chose to play with it a bit, to give it a bit of a wider scope in Regenerations by allowing the whole idea of, you know, as we know, our scouts, our humans who monitor the Doctor's behavior with such fascination, you know, and specifically dealing with Clive, there's the whole idea of the evidence of this man existing throughout time. Well, when we saw, as with Love and Monsters, you know, we do these things and you only have specific faces that you can utilize. You know, you only have so many things you can tap into. In Rose, obviously, Clive's evidence that he's discussing, all the footage that he's putting up on the internets, you know, 2005 internets, HTML 2.0.
It's a series of tubes.
is Eccleston, you know, or likenesses of Eccleston's face. Well, why not round that out a little bit? Somebody doing comprehensive research on this mysterious figure throughout time and space, or at least throughout Earth time, is going to come up with a couple of different faces. So we discussed that. Yeah. Man with a fantastic jaw, dressed in a tweed jacket and a bow tie, and apparently no eyebrows.
Right. Angry man in a caretaker's coat holding a mop with, you know, attack eyebrows.
I like this one. A blonde woman in braces running away from a giant frog in front of Buckingham Palace.
Okay. The tall, bald black woman wielding a flaming sword. I'm excited for that one.
Yep. Absolutely. Or the young girl or boy in a high-tech wheelchair with what looked like a robot dog at their side.
So you just have to hold on to hope, Keir.
Yeah.
He's coming back.
I'm going to be that robot dog one of these days. I am going to be K9 Mark VI. Well, so it's a fun way to be able to tinker with it. And apparently he was not the only one who chose to tinker with the stories a little bit as he went back to revisit them, because the Grand Moff did the same thing for Day of the Doctor.
And, yeah, this is kind of interesting because Moffat picked some interesting things to try and include in his novelization of the Day of the Doctor. So you've already got this blockbuster, huge story going on. Why not make it even bigger by including things like, well, how about River Song?
Yeah, exactly. About the if you're trying to figure out exactly how that all of the hiccups in their cross chronological relationships and things. We don't want to spoil anything, but you'll have the opportunity to be able to kind of play around with that a little bit. You've got the Peter Cushing meta solution. Is he canon?
He is now.
Insofar as it has been confirmed that he did play the Doctor, but he played the Doctor in a film that the Doctor approved of. So on that level, yeah, he was the Doctor in a movie that the Doctor watched. So take that for what it's worth. And he goes on with a few of these, and they're just these kind of fun ways of playing around with it. The colorizations and the multiple TARDIS situation that we've all wanted some solution to. Well, you don't really get that one. But it does get a little embellishment. If you haven't already placed your orders, because at this point, I don't even know if Target's producing them in large enough numbers to be able to meet the demand. Even if you were trying to order them from Amazon in the UK, you're looking at up to 4 weeks of wait time to receive your copy. So But I mean, how can it not be worth it? This is giving a classic treatment to new stories by authors that you know, love, and trust.
So definitely excited for those. The next thing we're excited for is apparently some returns of classic characters and monsters from series 11 or in series 11.
Right, but very vague. I mean, obviously, because we're only getting this from, you know, from hearsay from one of our BBC execs. So I don't. You can make whatever you want of it, but I mean, it's just a matter of.
I don't know that I believe that the execs even know what's happening in series 11.
Well, see, when they say return of classic characters and stuff, they're talking about, like, you know, the Doctor shows up again.
Yes.
The Daleks are from the classic series, so, you know, they're there.
True. But we never even really had confirmation that this may actually be a series that we do not have the Daleks. There's been some discussion of that, as to whether or not there's a way to sort of get around the Nation Clause.
What they did with the TV movie, throwing a sound effect in the opening of one, and, you know.
The thing that gives me kind of pause. Because, one, where do you frame in classic? Does classic mean the Master? Does classic mean the Autons? You know, so yes, it is a classic villain, but we've had them in the modern iteration, too. Is there something in there that lets us, that gives us something we haven't seen since the pre-96 era? That's what I'd like to see. Something really obscure. Give me the Zarbies. I want ant people. I don't know. It's just the right amount of completely useless information, but enough to get everybody intrigued and chatting about it. So now we get a few more months to wonder if set photos are going to, set report photos are going to spoil it for everyone. And of course, we'll get spoiled and then we'll complain about it, but then we'll talk about it anyway, because it's what we do. Back to hypothetical postulation.
That's what
Let's
we
do an
best.
Entire episode about what we think the classic reference might be.
Oh, yeah, because that's 45 minutes of intriguing podcast discussion right there.
So you mean like once a month every day in the off season? Like,
yes. I'm still holding out for Syl. I want Syl to come back.
Oh, God.
I want the
All right. Well, next week we will be coming back with our rewatch of Robot, the very first Tom Baker story.
Woo!
And we will
Who's Tom Baker?
You haven't met him yet. You'll like him.
We will be joined by Graham Burke of Reality Bomb.
Yes, so, looking forward to this.
Yes.
Graham is a wealth of interesting information and background knowledge on the episodes due to all the research and writing and interviews that he's done over the course of the years. So I'm sure he'll have a lot to contribute to this. And he is a huge Bakerphile, as I am. This is right in our wheelhouse. So looking forward to that one.
All right. Well, this has been episode 280 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, you know, that museum just sounds a lot more like a toy store. Like, I want that one and that one and that one and that one.
And this is Kier saying, they're not dollies, Mom. They're action figures.
And this is Haley saying, that belongs in a museum.
We'll see you guys next week.
Hello, Z.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.